go. She knows she's got everything that a woman needs to get a man. Yeah, yeah. How can she lose with the suit she used? 36, 24, 36. What a winning hand, 'cause she's a big house. She's mighty, mighty, just letting it all hang out.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, in the not-so-great white north. And today we have a very good show for you lined up today. At 3:30, we're going to be speaking with Marika Sherwood all the way from the United Kingdom. We're going to be doing a tribute to Bobby Bland at 3 o'clock, and at 2:30, we're going to be speaking with Gail Berry of Toronto. And during this first half an hour, we are playing some requests. And we had a request from Dee from Washington, D.C., and we played Brick House by the Commodores. And that song was led by Walter Clyde Orange. And Walter Clyde Orange was one of the leaders of the Commodores. Of course, the leader that everyone knows was Lionel Richie, who left the group in 1982. And the Commodores were supposed to go to South Africa. I think they did go. But one of their members by the name of Marlon Williams, Brother Marlon Williams, he refused to go. And the movement always remembers Marlon Williams. Then the Commodores cleaned this act up on the South African question, but we should remember Brother Marlon Williams, who is no longer with us. And we are going to go next to a request from Tanisha from Maryland, and she would like to hear Made to Love You by Gerald Levert. Gerald Levert was the son of Eddie Levert, and Gerald was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and he began his career as a member of the vocal group Levert, and his younger brother was Sean, who is no longer in the land of the living, and a friend by the name of Mark Gordon. They comprised Levert, and Gerald became a solo act in 1991, and he had a number of hits, and he collaborated with many, many, many artists. including he did a nice tune with Barry White, Practice What You Preach. And I guess everyone knows that he and his father recorded a single called Baby Hold On To Me. And Gerald, we lost Gerald in 2006. He was only 40 years old. So let's listen to Gerald LaVert.
Go, how could I forget the way I felt when I first set eyes on you? I remember saying to my friends, there is my future wife, and then I took the step to meet someone who would change my life. It had to be
are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we just listened to Gerald LaVert, and that went out to a sister in Maryland. And we also heard the Brick House, Brick House from the Commodores, and that went out to a sister in Chocolate City. I guess it's Neapolitan City now. I guess it's no longer Chocolate. But we would like to thank O'Malley Ishitella, Chairman O'Malley Ishitella, for granting us the space on Uhuru Radio to bring you diasporic music. We would also like to thank Archie Shep, who is the person who gave me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And we are, we cheat a little bit. We play music from the African continent as well. And you can email us at DJ at Uhuru Radio. Uhuru is U-H-U-R-U. Uhuru Radio, that's Swahili for freedom. And the Skype option is Uhuru Radio. North American, the North American phone number is 727-565-1599. North American, that's the North American number, and I'm assuming that if you're in Mexico, you can call us at that number because North America is Mexico, the United States, and Canada. And the UK is zero. You can call us from the UK at 020-8133-6629. This is Black Music Month, and we have been doing a number on Black Music Month, and the President of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama, who is currently, he was in South Africa, he may be in Tanzania now. I haven't been following the news like I should, but I know he had a lot of difficulties in South Africa. He flipped the script on us, and we had Black Music Month until he became president, and he changed it to African American Music Appreciation Month. And Maiso and Didan Sankara and myself put together a six-minute piece on Black Music Month. And let us just listen to this and tell us what you think.
Brother Norman, let me ask you, how did Black Music Month come into existence? I mean, like, who were the major players? What was their original vision?
Association started in 1979. The original vision of the organization basically was to promote Black music as a whole. When I say Black music as a whole, while the organization was formed in the United States, the vision was to fight for Black music, period. You know, African music, music from the Caribbean, music from England, because at that particular time and now, you have a lot of great Black music coming from not just England, but from Europe. And they were in the original vision. Black Music Month started with people like Evelyn Champagne King, the King of Rock and Roll, Chuck Berry, the veteran crooner, Billy Eckstein, the gospel great Andre Crouch, Maxwell Roach, Dizzy Gillespie. Charles Mingus was a part of the group, although he was gravely ill at that particular time. Kenny Gamble, the president of Philadelphia International, and a great disc jockey by the name of Ed Wright. Those were some of the players that helped create Black Music Month.
Brother Norman, at some point in time, Black Music Month was changed to African American Music Appreciation Month. Who made this decision, and what are the implications, if any, of the name change?
Well, from 1979 until 2009, Black Music Month was called Black Music Month, and President Barack Hussein Obama changed the name to African American Music Appreciation Month. Barack Hussein Obama was using the term American only to include Black people from Mississippi to Detroit, from Washington, D.C. to Seattle, Washington. He was only talking about Black people or African people in the United States. Implications of that is that that defused or that delinked African people. You know, we were talking about bringing African music together. We know that in the 60s, it has been said by Archie Shep that what John Coltrane played, Malcolm X said. You could also say that in the 80s, beginning in the 80s, what Walter Rodney said, Bob Marley sang. Later on, in the early 90s, you could probably say that what Fela Kuti sang is what Thomas Sankara said. There's always been the link between the music and the politics. So President Obama has basically defused and delinked all of that. The name change is very significant because it split the movement.
What a great point. Many of our people have never thought about how our music and our politics go hand in hand. You know, as African people, we use music for everything, whether it's in celebration, whether it's in mourning, even in communication. Music is right there, you know what I mean, in all that we do. And so that was an excellent point. Brother Norman, some would say that it's really no big deal for the name to be changed from Black Music Month to African American Music Appreciation Month. What would you say to that?
I think it was Richard B. Moore, the great brother from Barbados, said the dogs and slaves were named by their masters and free people named themselves. And Duke Ellington, one of the greatest musicians that ever walked the planet Earth, told us many, many years ago that if we didn't refer to our music as Black music, I think he used the term Negro music, but that was almost 100 years ago when he said this, that others could claim our music. And right now, we see that happening. We also have to be self-critical because while we sing, we dance, we run, we jump, other people are controlling the singing, the dancing, the running, and the jumping. We are a colonized people. We are an oppressed and exploited people by imperialisms, especially U.S. imperialism. And I think we have to create organizations that fight for our music and ourselves. You know, we have to fight as a people. The musicians, the radio people, the journalists, and so on and so forth, have to create their own organizations and fight for a better society, for an egalitarian arrangement, as opposed to a situation where we're singing, dancing, running, and jumping for someone else. We need to be an independent people as Africans everywhere in the world.
Listen, as we wrap this up, let me ask you about Black Music Month today. How should we be celebrating this month? What has Black music been through? How has it evolved over the last several decades?
You know, one of the things we have to realize as African people is that we are the flavor, as they used to say. Black music is the most popular music on the planet Earth, and we should be definitely proud of that, and we should take pride in the fact that the Fifth Jubilee Singers went to Europe in 1873 and knocked the socks off of Europe. We need to realize that in the 20s, jazz took the world by storm. We need to realize that the first million-selling album was a Calypso album by Harry Belafonte. Calypso swept the world. We need to realize that in 1967, the greatest singer in the world, according to Musical Express, was Otis Redding. Otis Redding dethroned Elvis Presley in terms of being the most popular singer in the world. We need to realize that in the 70s and the 80s, that the reggae music took the planet by storm. Robert Nesta Marley, Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, and the I3s. Hip-hop is the most dominant music on the planet Earth today. I mean, you can go to Kalamazoo, to Timbuktu, and the pop is all over. Asia, Africa, Latin America, all over Europe. And I think that is something that we as a people should be very proud of.
I want y'all to make some noise, kiddy yo.
Ananga Def, as they say in West Africa and Senegal. Greetings in Wolof, and we were listening to a piece that was produced by Maiso and Didan Sankara, and I did the vocals. And June is Black Music Month, and we are going to begin our campaign July the 1st. We're going to continue this campaign for Black Music Month, and we're going to become a little pest. We're going to pest President Barack Hussein Obama on this particular question. And Jessica from Virginia would like to hear Wind Me Up Chuck by Chuck Brown. Chuck Brown was born in Gaston, North Carolina, and was a local music legend in Chocolate City, or Neapolitan City, in the D.C. area. And he was known as the godfather of go-go which is a very popular music, a funky type music coming out of Washington, D.C. His biggest song was Busting Loose, and he's a singer-songwriter and self-taught guitarist, and he learned to play the guitar after trading cigarettes for a guitar while in a Virginia confinement facility. And Mr. Brown died in May of 2012. I had the honor of meeting Chuck Brown in Los Angeles in the studio of Logan Westbrook. Had a studio. Logan Westbrook's a very big record man, used to be with CBS Records. He recorded Chuck Brown. He recorded the Busting Loose album. And at that particular session, in walked in Charlie Wilson and his brother, who was no longer in the land of the living, Ronnie, the bass player, and also the Jamaican man, David Oliver, who did a great song called Miz. But we're going to listen to Chuck Brown, a legend, the legendary Chuck Brown, who is solely missed. This is Wind Me Up, Chuck.
I want y'all to make some noise, kiddy yo. One more time. Say what? I love you so much. Oh, you're spoiling me now. You're spoiling me, y'all. I want to start off easy. You're so breezy. I want to start off easy, y'all. A little bit loud. Oh, I love you so much. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Tell you nothing but the truth, you're looking out of sight. Want you to hold what you got. This is your spot. Do it like you want it because we love you a lot. Special shout going out to all the lovely young ladies. And we got some bad night horn plays up here. We're gonna let them warm up for you in a minute. Thank you.
Back. And the other name,
baby.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we were listening to Tina Marie and Gerald Levert. Every time I hear that song, I think about Tina Marie and Rick James, who lived in Toronto for many, many years. And I would like to thank Sister Liv for putting some of the music together. And joining me on the line is Gail Berry. And Gail Berry was born and raised in Toronto, Ontario. And she began her career as an entertainer at a very, very young age, tap dancing solo at the CNE, at the Canadian National Exhibition. That's where it all began, and she was exposed to many types of music and from her family and friends, and she is a trilingual vocalist, Italian, I think Spanish, and of course English. And she has sang rhythm and blues, gospel, soul, funk, jazz, and many, many other styles. She has performed all over the world. She performed with Stevie Wonder in Naples. She did work with Richie Valens in Rome, and she toured with the Tribute to the Platters in Europe. And in Canada, she did work with Martha Reeves, and she did work with the Marvelettes and Frida Payne, Melville Moore, Percy Sledge, Dorothy Moore, and Celine Dion. And on the reggae scene, she's worked with Jay Douglas, Sly and Robbie, and many others. And Ms. Berry, how are you doing?
I'm well today. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. And
good.
I basically am very happy that you're on Diasporic Music. And we have started basically a new feature. We're going to interview someone from Canada every week.
Wonderful.
We're really on Toronto now, but we have Nova Scotia, we have Montreal, we have Ottawa. We've interviewed Kenny Hamilton out of Hamilton before. We've interviewed quite a few people from Canada, but we decided to make this a permanent situation. So,
that's great, and thank you for recognizing us.
But I've been knowing you for many moons, and I saw your sister in at the Parkdale Library the other day, and she told me to plug her new gospel album. So I guess I'm gonna have to do that.
What?
Your sister Linda Berry.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I don't know if you remember this, but I and Linda and someone else did a couple of rehearsals a couple of times I think we were somewhere in Toronto in an apartment trying to put together a group many years ago. Or do you remember that?
I remember that, but I don't remember my sister being involved. I remember one of my cousins, or two of my cousins being involved in it.
Who was that?
Leslie.
Leslie. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay. But when is the last time have you recorded recently, or are you recording now?
If I've recorded, it would be background vocals for another artist project, which would be my sister. That was the last thing that I've recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I did a country and western CD for a Canadian gentleman that frequents Nashville very often. Colina Phillips and I did background vocals for his CD.
Colina Phillips is out of Hamilton. We've interviewed her
yes.
on this series already.
Yes.
Now, you were born in Toronto. I have to ask you this question about which church did you go to?
The BME and the AME.
Oh, you went to both?
Yes.
The
British Methodist Apostle.
Well, were you there when Ms. Trotman was leading the flock, or?
Oh no! Prior to that, his name was Reverend Markham.
But Miss Trotman was the choir director, I believe. That was probably before your time, probably, right?
Possibly.
And the AME Church, who was the person that was head of the choir at that time?
Oh, I'm not sure because I was never involved with the choirs.
Okay. so you didn't...
No.
You didn't come out of the church singing situation?
No, not at all.
Uh-huh.
The first artist I performed with was a gentleman by the name of George Oliver, and he had a rhythm and blues band.
I remember George Oliver, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he had a 10-piece rhythm and blues band. And so
were you doing background vocals or were you lead vocals as well?
Background vocals.
Mm-hmm.
After George, then I did lead vocals with a trio and then a quartet and then a quintet. But my pleasure is singing background vocals. It's more of a challenge. I think anybody can sing solo. But I love working with intricate harmonies. That's more of a challenge for me.
And who influenced you as a singer in terms of as lead vocalist as well as background vocals?
I'd have to say Ella Fitzgerald, Nancy Wilson, Dinah Washington, Chaka Khan, Minnie Riperton.
Mm-hmm. In terms of when I was singing, I used to really like to listen to Eddie Kendricks. Sing background.
Lest we forget Eddie Kendricks.
But I'm saying Eddie Kendricks in terms of him as a background singer. I remember reading once what David Ruffin said, that he would be singing background with Eddie, and Eddie would be sounding so pretty he would forget what he was singing and mess up, you know.
Well, that would happen when I'd sing with Jackie and Betty Richardson. We did a gospel show at one point. After the show, I just cried. It was, I felt so good. And so the harmonies, the blend of the vocals together, brought tears to my eyes, as music often does.
Right. I am speaking with Gil Berry of Toronto, Ontario. Now, let's talk about this trilingual thing that you do. I know, I understand you can speak Italian fluently.
That's correct. That's correct.
And is it Spanish or French?
Spanish.
Oh, Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
How long did you stay in Italy?
14 years, on and off. Yes.
Okay. So here you. And you did. Were you doing the Tribute to the Platters for those 14 years, or were you?
Initially, it was a Tribute to the Platters. I left, I lived and performed in Syria and Greece. I then went back to Rome and started working for the Rai Television. And then that opened doors for doing recording sessions in English. They always needed English vocalists at the time.
Right.
So that opened a lot of doors. So I was working mostly in television and in the studios. Concerts, live performances.
Now, the Tribute to the Platters, I assumed you were doing Zora Taylor's parts.
Yes, the female vocals.
Now, is it Zola or Zora? Zola.
Zola.
Zola went to school at a school called Manual Arts High School, and I remember just a few days before my leaving the United States, I was in Los Angeles. I saw her and Frankie Lyman together because they were linked up at that particular time. And the Platters, I guess, were the with the one woman and the male singers. I guess that was. Were they the first people to do that, or do you know?
That I couldn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
But it may very well be, because I cannot think of another group back in that era that had such a
one
formation.
Woman. Right. Yeah. And how, who did you, you sing, did you sing any leads, or you just were strictly background as a tribute to the Platters?
We would do the Platter songs but each person would have a lead vocal at the beginning of the show, and then we continue with the platter songs.
Oh, you did like your own a cover or somebody's song, and then you did platter stuff?
Yes, you mentioned Frankie Lyme, and one of the songs that I did sing at that time was Why Do Fools Fall in Love?
Why do fools? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, wah, ooh, wah, ooh.
You know, there's a copy of George Clinton singing that on a, as a tribute, there's a CD from Philadelphia artists are doing Detroit, and Detroit artists are doing Philadelphia stuff.
Well, that's interesting, because George and the Funkadelics lived in Toronto, and we used to hang out with them back in the day.
Who besides George, it was Gary and...
Gary Scheider, rest in peace. Let's see, there was a gentleman called Cool Pop. Oh, I can't remember the bass player. Colin, not Collins. There was a bass player.
Boogie.
Boogie. That's
he called himself Boogie, but Cordell, I think, was his name.
Cordell, correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So they hung out in Toronto. Along with also like Rick James. We had the same manager at one point when he was here in Toronto.
Who was that manager? Was it?
I do not remember his name for the life of me.
It was
also
kind of a stout guy.
Pardon me?
The guy was kind of a stout gentleman?
Not really.
Okay,
a Caucasian gentleman. Yeah, I don't remember his name. Another gentleman that was influential in Toronto at the time was John Ussery.
And Johnny Ussery, I think, is in Italy now. He was from Philadelphia, right?
Yeah, and he lived in Toronto for years. I haven't seen him for about 10 years.
Right. No, Johnny's in Italy now.
Okay, that's good. So the Sound of Philadelphia, he brought that to Toronto, and there were a lot of productions and a lot of artists involved.
Right.
Like Demo Cates, myself, Tabby Johnson, Tabara, I should say.
Tabara, she sang on Standing on the Top. She's on, singing soprano on that particular song,
yeah,
right?
Because when Rick lived here, he met, you know, the artists, and then she went out to California to work with him. Wayne Thompson, I think it's Wayne Jackson. He was a
Wayne Jackson
player.
Was out of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yes, he lived here for a while.
He's missing in action. We've been looking for him for years.
Oh, he's in California, not doing very well. I heard he had a lung transplant, but I could get his number for you if need be. Yeah.
No, we all went to see Rick. When we were in Los Angeles, I went to Los Angeles with J.W. McGee, Wayne.
Oh, James McGee, yes.
Right.
We were in a group called Salongo.
Salongo, I remember Salongo. And we went to Rick James when Rick was living in the Hearst Mansion.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
He was living in the Hearst Mansion, and he had a...
Oh, boy.
The biggest bag of... Mary Jane that I've ever seen in my life.
That's
I mean, Rick was a very...
Rick was Rick.
I found he treated me like royalty.
You know, he was so talented. So talented. Brilliant. A brilliant artist. And I hope he's resting in peace also.
Yeah, but Rick was a very intelligent man. I don't think people recognize how...
Mm-hmm.
How intellectually, I mean, he was, you know, a lot of history, African history, Europe, history of, you know, Canadian history, and he knew music backwards, forward, and sideways.
Yes, I mean, he did.
All types of, not just black music, but, you know, any kind of music, he was into that.
Mm-hmm.
But you, I think one time I saw you at the, I think it was a generator, and we were watching, I think, Ray Goodman and Brown. Ray Goodman and Brown, I think you were there at the club scene in Toronto. It used to be very, very, very bright, vibrant if you were working, I guess, as well as if you wanted to see talent. How does the scene look in 13?
I'm not really in the club circuit anymore. So I don't have an answer for that, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. No, but I'm saying it seems like the club situation has dried up all over the world, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Not,
mm-hmm.
It's nowhere near what it used to be when, you know, when I was coming up and when I came to Toronto. Toronto was one of the most exciting places to live, I think, in the world at that particular time, because, I mean,
yeah,
every type of music was coming out of here.
That's right. We had the Colonial, the Cock Door, the Hawk's Nest, Soul City. Those were the hot spots.
The Hawk's Nest, was Ronnie Hawkins?
Ronnie Hawkins.
Ronnie Hawkins was out of Arkansas, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I've worked with a bass player that came up with Ronnie Hawkins from the United States back in the day. But the Hawk's Nest was great. You know, King Curtis, Irma Franklin, the Funkadelics, the Parliaments. There's so much entertainment in Toronto at that time.
I remember walking down Yonge Street one time, and where the Le Coq d'Or used to be, now is HMV, and I remember just bumping into Jimi Hendrix right there on the streets. And
wow.
I remember seeing Bo Diddley walking down the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Lola Falana, I mean, the Spinners. It was...
Power.
Yeah.
Ruby and the Romantics, they were at a club called the Brown Derby.
The Brown Derby was on, yes, the Brown
on
Derby.
On Yonge Street,
right.
Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ever perform at the, what's the club? It used to be on Adelaide. I used to see Jackie Shane there.
The Savern?
The Savern. Did you ever perform there?
Yes, we did. That's when we had
you
the
You performed with Salongo at the
yes.
Savern.
Yes.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You, who was in Salongo? You, Jay, and who else?
James McGee, Newton, who has since passed on. I hope he's resting in peace. Lucky Gary, Wayne Jackson, Kung Fu. He was a drummer from Grenada. That's all the musicians that I can. Oh! There's a guitar player, a gentleman that's based out of Oakville, and I can't remember his name for the life of me.
Lucky Gary is played bass, right?
Yes.
And Lucky Gary is the nephew of Harry Gary, who
the
is
the grandson.
The grandson, pardon me.
Yes.
Grandson of Mr. Gary, who was came to Toronto in 19 whatever. I think Mr. Gary may have come from Cuba, but he was a very significant person in our community, in Toronto.
That's correct.
And I found an interview that I did with him many, many moons ago. I'm going to have to digitize it.
Mm-hmm.
So you really had the history of Toronto. We need to. Someone needs to do a documentary just on the history during that particular period.
Mm-hmm. Now there was a show that we did in October with Archie Arlene, and that was more or less a tribute to the black artists. It was the older generation like Eric Mercury, Jay Douglas, Jay Jackson, Sean Jackson, and so he tried to incorporate that era,
right,
with the black artists at that time.
Yeah, because Archie was on the show last week.
Wonderful.
And that Archie, I guess Archie is almost 80. So
he
yes. Yeah, he'll be 80, I think, in January. But Archie is, I think there's another gentleman who plays vibes that might be a little bit older than Archie. I can't recall this brother's name. But Archie is, I guess, the the person that's still around that has seniority over everybody else, I guess.
Yes. Mm-hmm. At this point. This age. Yeah.
Yes, gonna.
He's the pioneer.
He's a pioneer. Now, have you ever sang for like the Harry Jerome Awards? You ever done anything around that? I'm sorry.
Yes, I believe with possibly with Jackie Richardson and Betty.
The Harry Jerome Awards are an award. The awards are named after the great sprinter from I guess Harry was from out west. I guess he made his name in Vancouver, but they honor black people in Toronto who made contributions in education, health, medicine, so on and so forth. But you performed there, huh?
I believe I have.
Uh-huh, but...
Don't quote me.
And what... In 2013, what are you doing musically? 2013,
musically, my performance is still studio sessions, and I need to pull together a CD. I've sang on many, many, many artists' CDs, but I've never really focused on my own, and that's what I plan to do this year.
You have any idea in terms of who would produce it?
Not at this moment.
And what kind of what is your concept? What would you like to do? Original, mixture of originals, the standards, jazz?
Well, I like to do two things. I'd love to do like jazz standards. That would be one CD, covers of jazz standards. My favorite standards. And also, there's a gentleman that I've worked with in the past, and I'd like to... It's not funk, it's not jazz, I guess you could call it pop, and I'd like to get that down and have that produced as a CD.
So what some of the standards, jazz standards that you like, tell me some of the jazz standards that you like.
Oh, You Don't Know What Love Is, Lush Life, Yesterday's. Chega de Saudade, No More Blues, Willow Weep for Me, what is this thing called, Love.
And who's your favorite jazz composer?
Ooh! I don't think I have a favorite.
That's kind of a silly question.
I don't think I have a favorite, yeah. Because, you know, my favorite music, to be honest with you, is Arabic and Greek and Latin. So if I could incorporate those elements, that would be fantastic.
Arabic, can you speak any Arabic other than Assalamu Alaikum and that?
Naam. Just a little bit.
Inshallah.
Yeah, inshallah.
Yeah. Inshallah. Oh, you spent. How long did you live? Did you live in Syria?
9 months.
Oh,
almost a year.
Uh huh.
And then almost a year in Greece, also. So there's that influence. I guess that's why I love the music so much.
In terms of people that look like you and I, what was it like in terms of Syria as well as in Greece as well as Italy? There are. Black people, I guess, all over the world. But
that's correct, yes. For example, when I lived in Syria, the lady cook in the kitchen, she was from Saudi Arabia, but she was black.
It looked just like you and me, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Lots of Africans, North Africans, Ethiopians, like Moroccans, Somalians in Rome, in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And Greece, there were a few black, not so many, but I'm sure there are more now.
And how do you keep your Italian now? I guess that's a dumb question because there's so many Italians in Toronto, I guess you just talk to someone, right?
Yeah, but it's frequent, and it's not like I have a lot of Italian friends. So I listen to Italian music. I watch Italian movies and documentaries on television, and that's how I keep it up.
You know something? I had a copy somewhere of the Temptations singing My Girl in Italian.
That's interesting.
And I think that it's in a film.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. Whoa, what was the film? It was a film. The next time I talk to you, I'll let you know the film. But no, David Ruffin singing My Girl in Italian.
Wow.
Beautiful, beautiful, mm-hmm. beautiful.
Because it is a romantic language.
Right.
Very romantic and musical.
And you said you can speak, how did you learn Spanish?
Well, it's very close to Italian.
Right.
So I don't speak it, but I sing it more than I speak it.
And living, you didn't hook up the French situation then?
I can also sing in French, if need be. I have the productions that we did in Italy, there were songs that we performed in French.
And Arabic, that's interesting, Arabic, you're interested in, you listen to a lot of music in Arabic?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh. I've been listening to a lot of music from India, Hindi and stuff like that, but the...
Also, yes.
Right.
Yes.
There is a station here in Toronto that I listen to, and I'm a tabla freak.
Mm-hmm.
A tabla, and but the you know, John Coltrane and Eric Dolphin, those guys were really incorporated a lot of the Arabic things, and I think there was a brother named Joe Harriet out of the Jamaican brother who's lived in England. He did a lot of that stuff as well, and but I guess musicians always have respected one another, you know, like it's a back and forth thing.
That's true. People from
the West and all over.
Mm-hmm. That's so true.
Is there anything else you would like to add? I was speaking with Gail Berry, Toronto, of Toronto, Canada, a pioneer in many musics, and she's been a lot of time in other countries, and she's one of my favorite people.
Oh, thank you kindly. Thank you
I've
so much.
Known Ms. Berry for a few minutes.
And then some.
Right. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, but I just wanted to thank you so much for thinking of me and having me as a guest on your show. I'm honored. It's a real pleasure.
Appreciate it. We will do it again, because I really, really would like to explore the international situation. I think we should go into detail in terms of when you lived in Syria and Greece and and Italy. And
yes, I still have friends that are there now.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in, I'm an internationalist. I like to deal with people from all over the planet Earth. That's one of the things that I've learned since I've been living in Canada. You can commingle, you can meet and coalesce with people from all over the world, which is, I think, is a good thing personally.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right, Ms. Berry, thank you very much.
I thank you, and I send you blessings, and to everyone that's listening.
All right, thank you.
Okay, take care. Be safe.
All right.
Bye for now.
We have been speaking with Gail Berry, and now we're going to go to our, this is Norman Otis Richmond, and we're going to go to our tribute to I Am This Man's biggest fan, Bobby Blue Bland.
Yay!
Norman Otis Richmond is his biggest fan. I saw him when I was 10 years old. This is
Oh, you're lucky.
Bobby Blue Bland.
Amen.
All right.
so strange without you there. Things have changed.
I'm the fly about it. Your hips have got me feeling body talking good to me, but I think I'm the fuck up. If you wanna roll with me, then here's a chance to win 80 on the freeway. Catch me if you can.
Ain't no love.
Varigani, and this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada, and we are paying tribute to Bobby Blue Bland. And Bobby Blue Bland, we heard Bobby Blue Bland and Tupac, Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City. We also heard Bobby Blue Bland's Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City. And that was from the film American Gangster. They promoted, when they promoted American Gangster, that was a song they played, Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City. Jay-Z recorded a rendition of Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City, but I couldn't play it because if I played it, there would be no more Uhuru Radio, because I think the FCC would bar us, because there is some real spicy language in that particular rendition by Jay-Z. Bobby Bland, I remember seeing Bobby Bland when I was 10 years old. My mother took me and my sister Lorraine and my baby sister Helen Anita, who was 6 at the time, and my other sister Lorraine was probably 8, and she's 18 months younger than I am, and we went to the Fox Theater in Los Angeles, California, and Lil' Junior Parker was pardon me, was the headliner, and Don and Dewey were on the show, and Bobby Bland picked up my little sister, who was very small. She was very small, even at 6 years old, and he sang to her, and I've been a fan of Mr. Bland ever since. I've seen him in Buffalo, New York, Los Angeles, and in Toronto, and we're going to play some Bobby Blue Bland and some Little Junior Parker and some Al Green, and come back and talk to you. This is our tribute to Bobby Blue Bland.
each time you see me, things won't be the same. Yes, next time you see me, things won't be the same. And if it hurts you, my darling, you only have yourself to blame. Like a true sin, all that shine is not gold. Yes, like a true sin, all that shine is not gold. And like the good book say, you got to read just what you sow. Where you lied, cheated, for so long. Where you lied, cheated, for so long. You're just a wrong-done woman, another queen is on your throne.
are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, and we are paying tribute to Bobby Blue Bland. We heard Take Me to the River by Al Green. That was Little Junior Parker's cousin, and we heard Junior Parker do Next Time You See Me, and we heard Turn On Your Love Lights by Bobby Bland. And in 1992, Mr. Bland was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he, like I said, the film American Gangster, they promoted his music in that particular film. And Bobby Bland, when he passed away, I remember I went, Angela Davis was speaking in Toronto that night, and Bobby Bland was playing at a club called the Colonial, and I was told that my father had passed away, and I remember I said, I'm going to hear Bobby Bland, because I was just thinking about my father, who I used to listen to Bobby Blue Bland with all the time. I was, like I say, probably Bobby Blue Bland's biggest fan. Like I say, when he picked up my little sister and sang to her, that was all. I became a fan of his for life, and I actually told him that when I saw him in Buffalo, New York. He was at the Trafalmador, a nice club in Buffalo, and I had a chance to talk to him, and I took my wife to see Bobby Bland, because I wanted her to see Mr. Bland, and Yvonne Kentish was my wife, and she, Bobby Bland told me that, I think at that particular time, he was married to a Jamaican woman. Also, Al Green, at one time, he may still be married to a Jamaican woman, but Bobby Bland was my man, and I really wanted to, I've taken everybody I know to see Bobby Bland, like I say, because I guess I'm his biggest disciple. But right now, we're going to flip the script, and we're going to go to B.B. King with Bobby Bland. And this is live on Soul Train with Brother Don Cornelius.
The blues, Mr. B.B. King, and I'd just like to say to you, B.B., that we really appreciate having you.
Thank you. It's an honor for us to be here, that you would have us.
By us, I think you're alluding to the fact that a special guest is here, and yes, we might as well bring him on in, Mr. Bobby Blue Bland. How about it for him?
Yes, sir.
As I've probably mentioned before, this, of course, was prompted by the album that you and Bobby did together, BB on ABC Dunhill, together for the first time, which, you know, was one of the most fantastic things I've ever heard. And anybody that says that they didn't like that album, they didn't know what they were listening to.
Well,
I read a review that was kind of negative.
Yeah, and they ripped us off.
You know, people shouldn't write about things they don't understand, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't know about Bobby, but I'd like to mess up some more, just like that.
And also, a lot of our viewers are probably aware of the fact that on a recent show we did with Bobby, you were a special guest, and this, of course, is BB's show, and
well,
we thought we'd try it again the other way around.
Well, Dan,
because it was so fantastic.
Well, it's a pleasure, and it's always nice to be with you, and it's always a pleasure to be with BB.
Dude, I'm going to let you guys start to stinking up here a little bit, all right?
Right on.
How about a gang for BB King and Bobby Bland?
I don't know. treat me the way you want to do.
Should be nice to a friend until I can see my love a better day. It seems like my luck's been running bad here lately. everything I do, Chinatra. And it seemed like my luck's been running bad here lately. Everything I do, Chinatra.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And we were paying tribute to Bobby Blue Bland, and Bobby Blue Bland was performing with B.B. King on the Soul Train show. And I just purchased a book, Soul of the Man, Bobby Bland by Charles Farley, and I'm definitely going to read that because I think I am probably Bobby Bland's biggest fan on earth. And joining me on the line from England is Marika Sherwood, who is a person that I've heard nothing but good things about. And Ms. Sherwood was born in Hungary, and
a very long time ago.
All right. With the remains of her Jewish family, she immigrated to Australia in 1948. She had a brief stint in New Guinea, where she was introduced to racism and colonialism. She returned to Sydney and attended university as a part-time student, and then immigrated to the quote-unquote mother country. With her son in 1965, she was teaching in London schools, and she was it introduced her to many aspects of racism that were in the UK, and she basically has been in England for quite a while, and she wrote a great book called Malcolm X and His Travels Abroad, and she comes highly recommended from Abdul Al-Kaliman and also Abdul Mr. Razak in New York City. And I'm very honored to be interviewing Ms. Sherwood. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for all the flattery.
No, I've heard Abdul and Abdullah.
Mm-hmm.
Abdullah was Malcolm X's second in command.
Yes,
and, he speaks very highly of you, and I would like to tell you that he always talks about people. He is always being interviewed, and no one sends him a book. But he said Marika Sherwood, she sent me a copy of a book, so you're in his good book.
Well, I couldn't have written the book without him. It's as simple as that.
Now, Mr. This book came out in what I brought it. First of all, I bought the book in Los Angeles, California, at Esalen Bookstore, and I understand you've been to Los Angeles.
Yes, yes, yes. I was invited there by Professor Bobby Hill, and gave some talks at the university and in some other places, which was absolutely wonderful. And let me tell you what was wonderful about it particularly, and I don't know if this is California or if it's the whole of the USA. I lived in New York from 1980 to 85.
5 years.
Yes. And it was very, very painful experience. Because of the level of racism were all my black colleagues, and then because it was totally unaccepted by at least some of my colleagues that this white woman should be writing about any aspect of the history of black peoples. I was writing about black peoples in Britain. And that caused some controversy, and that too was very, very painful. But when I was in California, there was nothing like that there. You know, it didn't seem to matter that my skin was white. People were listening to what I was saying and asking questions about what I had said. And none of it was focused on, well, what would this white woman understand? So maybe there's been a lot of change in the USA.
Well, when I was growing up in the U.S. of A., I grew up in Los Angeles, and for quite a while, I would have been on the saying, well, what is this white woman doing writing about, black mm-hmm. affairs? But I studied Malcolm, mm-hmm. and I don't think personally that biologically white folks are the devil, so I flip-flop my position because of Malcolm X, so mm-hmm. I can work with anybody that is has good politics, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I did quote Malcolm X and some of my exchanges in New York, but let me tell you a bit of my experience that I think gives me a sort of 1% sense of what it's like to be a black person in a racist society. As you said, I was growing up a little Jewish girl in Budapest, and I look like all other Hungarians. You couldn't tell me from anybody else. I was never noticed on the streets. But then you had to wear a yellow Star of David on your clothes every time you went out the door. So suddenly on the street I was being name-called and spat at. I suppose, I don't know how many of those Hungarians really were Nazis, or if they just felt that they had to behave like that because of the number of police around.
Right.
But that, you know, that I kept remembering that when I was encountering racism and how horrific it was, and that I could take off the Star of David, and black people cannot change the color of their skin, nor should they, of course. But, you know, it perhaps gives me a different sense of understanding from people who haven't been through anything like that.
Right. But this Malcolm X book, mm-hmm. Malcolm X Visits Abroad, and I must admit that you went to Trace Malcolm's, he went to Africa, I guess the Middle East, as well as Europe, France,
yes.
and England.
Yes.
And why, or how much time did it take for you to do the research to put this book together, and how many places did you have to visit?
Well, it took about 18 months to put it together. I must tell you that I never get research money in this country. In Britain, it's not accepted to be doing research on any aspect of the history of black peoples here, so there's never research money. So I couldn't follow in Malcolm's footsteps around Africa, which I think is what needs to be done.
Right.
So all I could do was read his travel notebooks, which were available at the Schomburg Center in New York, and then look at all the local newspapers in the British Library here in London, and, of course, here in England, talk with people who had met Malcolm when he was over here. So the book is not nearly as comprehensive as I would have liked it to be. Now, the reason I embarked on it is not just because people here in Britain didn't know that he had been here, you know, except for the people who had actually met him. It's written out of history. But because as I began to read his travel notebooks, I became more and more convinced that the American government had to have Malcolm obliterated, let's put it that way. I don't quite know what word one should be using. If you have somebody who is front page news around the world, like Malcolm was, talking about American dollarism and warning not only the Organization of African Union, but also every country that he visited about the dangers of American dollarism. You can't let that man live. You can't let that man live. You know, he was talking about something so fundamental about what some people call neocolonialism. The dangers of dollarism are there today. Just look at the state of Africa. Malcolm couldn't be allowed to live, and he knew that. And the more I read his book and then followed up, the more painful it became, and the more I admired him, because he knew he was going to be killed, and he knew why he was going to be killed, because of what he was saying. But that didn't stop him saying what he wanted to say. Now, that takes an enormous amount of courage when you know that sooner or later they will manage to kill you.
Could I interrupt you here? I remember reading Manny Marable's book, and I was very upset at one of the things he said, that, you know, Malcolm was so worried, which he was, that he drank the rum and coke in Ghana, and he didn't say, you know, it was good or bad, didn't make a judgment on it, but the whole thing, I guess if you're under that pressure, so if he drank a rum and coke, you know, like, so what? That was my attitude. And I understand you were involved in that Manning Marable project, but you were kind of shut out, or is that true?
Yes, I had known, well, I met Marable when I was living in New York. I admired him. He was left-wing, and I am left-wing. I must be very honest about that. I'm proud of it, too. I'm against capitalism. So I admired Marable, but then he came to Columbia in New York, and his politics seemed to change. Anyway, he had heard that I was researching Malcolm, so on one of my visits to New York, he said, would I come and speak to his students, which I did. Would I mind being filmed by his research assistants about what my concerns were? I said, no, I don't mind. So I was. And what I expected Marable to do, because he had lots of research money, was to do what I asked. Go and follow in Malcolm's footsteps around Africa. Find all the people he met. Interview them all. Look at all the newspapers that we don't have access to, either in the Library of Congress or here at the British Library. And Manning did nothing like that. And I think he totally misrepresents Malcolm. I think, to me, the book is absolutely appalling. Absolutely appalling.
Well, we've had a lot of discussions on Uhuru Radio and on my show, Diasporic Music, about the book, and many people, I guess it was very, 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 very controversial. A lot. There were a few people that supported him, but I think, I don't know if he won a Nobel. He won many prizes and, you know, got New York Times reprinted it, but it looked like the African liberation movement, most people rejected it. But I wanted to ask you about what role did Jan Carew play? Because Jan Carew was a very good friend of mine, and Jan is no longer in the land of the living. I guess I can say this now. But Jan helped many of us who refused to go to Vietnam. I mean, he was a 20th century Underground Railroad man. And what role did Mr. Carew, who was born in Guyana, play in this book?
Listen, he really didn't. I also knew Jan. I met him here in London. But no, he didn't play any role in this book, because I would have, well, he just didn't let me put it that way. There's no negative reasons for it at all.
Right.
You know, to talk about Malcolm, you have to be face to face, and we just couldn't be face to face. I told you I don't get any money for research, so traveling around is very difficult. It's very difficult.
Why why can't you get money? Because you're not a PhD, or you're not tied to a university. What is the issue?
No, the issue is that that this country does not want to admit that it had a population of African origins or descent until 1948.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Africans have lived here since they first arrived as a regiment within the Roman army. And we now know that it wasn't just a regiment, because not very long ago, a grave was dug up north of London of a woman of African origins with a lot of jewelry. So she's clearly a very wealthy woman. We don't yet know who on earth she was, but, you know, clearly there was an African woman who was also wealthy. So I doubt if she was the only one.
All right.
Now, the governments here, and it doesn't matter whether it's Labour or Conservative, they simply don't want to admit that we have had a black population for 2,000 years.
So it's just like the Democrats and Republicans in the United States. They're both two capitalist parties.
Yep. And you just cannot have that. Now, I would love to have a DNA survey done of British people from Scotland down to Cornwall, just to see how many DNAs show some level of African descent. You know, I can't guess how many it would be.
Right.
But we certainly had Africans here, and there is now some research, very little, on Africans here in the Renaissance period and in the Tudor period, so 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries. But we have no courses except for two in the whole country on this history, because they don't want it taught and they don't want it researched. I have been trying to set up a taught master's course, because there would be lots of students who would take a taught master's course. And all the universities I approach say, oh, yes, yes, well, it would be very interesting, but sorry, there's just no money for anything like that. You know, and then I say, well, given the fees that we now charge for university courses, you don't need any money. There'd be enough students to pay for the lectures. Oh, no. You know, it's just not history they want to know. So it wouldn't matter whether I had six PhDs or none. I don't have one, but I have, I think, seven books in print. you know, it's not to do with that. It's to do with this isn't our history.
Right. I wanted to ask, had you finished? I'm sorry for cutting you off.
Sorry?
I said I'm sorry for cutting you off. Had you finished?
No, that's all right.
Abdullah Razak, Malcolm... Mm-hmm. He was Malcolm's second in command, and he spent 13, 14, maybe 13 years in Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in New York. I think his father was born in Virginia, and his father was a member of the Communist Party in the United States, but Abdullah is a Muslim, and how much did he help you?
Oh, enormously. I mean, not only did he give me information, but he encouraged me to go on to do the work, because, you know, I was unsure, not only because I didn't have the money, but, you know, I am a Hungarian. I lived only for 5 years in New York. So even the most superficial understanding is, you know, I wasn't sure I had it. But no, he was wonderful. After our conversations, he just said, no, go ahead, right, you know. And if you need to know any more, just come back to me. I'll tell you what I know. So support like that is absolutely crucial when you're very uncertain if you can do justice to what you are researching, never mind Justice DeMarcum, which, you know, of course, I mean, that's a joke, you know. No way can I achieve that. But I hope that I have opened the door for some people to really look at the last year of Malcolm's life, which he spent mainly abroad. And he spent it not only talking about dollarism and neocolonialism and the racism in this country, but also meeting many politically active people wherever he went. Mainly, and I could be quite wrong, I told you I wasn't able to follow his footsteps, but certainly the people I know he met were all what we would call left-wing people. By which I mean that they were talking about the necessity for socialism, for equality, and of course to do away with colonialism and the racialism that was suffusing the whole world. So looking at what Malcolm did in the last year of his life, I think is very, very important to all of us who see ourselves as part of this struggle and want to understand the history of the struggle.
I'm speaking with Marika Sherwood, and I was influenced by El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, and my generation. We had to choose whether or not we were going to follow the Nation of Islam or whether or not we were going to follow El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X. And I basically wanted to put on the record right now that Mr. Muhammad, I have nothing but respect for Mr. Muhammad, but I disagree with him politically. I supported Malcolm X's ideas. And I think that if you check out the record, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit, the Revolutionary Action Movement, SNCC, the Black Panthers, of course, those people supported the secular side of Malcolm because Malcolm was a Muslim, but he basically said to put your politics first, and if your religion wasn't doing anything for you, you know, to put it in a closet, throw it, you need to get away with it, throw it away anyway. And, you know, other people supported, Imam Jamil Alameen, pardon me, you know, they supported, became Sunni Muslims. But the whole question of socialism, I agree with you because Malcolm basically pointed us in that direction.
Yes. He wanted very much for us all to go in that direction. And I mean, I don't know that much about Islam, but I don't think Islam would be against socialism. You know, we don't look at the very sad conflict between Sunni and the Shia now, and, you know, we need to sort of dig beneath the wall to see who is manipulating whom in that. But what I have read about Muhammad, and I have read his life story, and I have read about Islam, I don't think Islam is against socialism at all.
I don't either, because Thomas Sankara from Burkina Faso made the statement that, you know, if he was on an island, he would want three books. He would want the Bible, he would want a Quran, and he would want a copy of State and Revolution by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. And he said that, you know, in this period of history, that Lenin was the most concrete example of what was happening today. But Islam had some, you know, some principles, egalitarian principles, as well as, so Jesus did chase the money chasers out of the
Yep.
You know, Jesus was not a capitalist.
No, he certainly wasn't. I think Jesus was a great revolutionary. I don't think many in the Christian churches would appreciate me saying that, but I think he was.
We are really running out of time, and I definitely want to bring you back and continue this discussion. We have a few more minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
But I basically wanted to go on record to tell everyone to pick up a copy of Malcolm X Visits Abroad by Marika Sherwood, who published the book. It's a Los Angeles, it's a American publisher, right?
Yes, yes. In America, it's an American publisher. It's called Sahai Publishers in California.
And how did you get a hold of them?
Oh. Well, we met when I was in California before the meeting we talked about. And
with Professor Bobby Hill.
Yeah. And Elias and I talked, and he said, well, I'd be very happy to publish it. So I was delighted.
Did you ever go to the Esalen bookstore in Los Angeles?
No, I don't remember.
Okay, yeah.
I don't remember the names of the bookstores I went to, but, I went to where various colleagues directed me to go.
Right. I mean, I thought you might have had a book. I bought the book from Esalen Bookstore, which was James Fugate, and runs the Esalen Bookstore. And
mm-hmm.
He's had everybody in that bookstore from you to Bill Clinton to Barack Hussein Obama and so on and so forth. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Because we're going to have to get off of this phone, and definitely, like, I definitely want to invite you back.
No, not about Malcolm, except perhaps to say that we all owe him a lot. And please read the book, because what he was doing in that last year of his life is very, very important and very relevant to the world today. Very relevant to the world today.
And one last thing, your latest book, could you talk about it for 2 seconds? Or for
the latest book is very different. It's on World War II and the contributions of colonies and colonials and what the British government was doing in the colonies, which was jailing a lot of people. And I wrote that because we all talk about World War II and we completely ignore the 650,000 Africans who fought for Britain and the 2.5 million Indians who fought for Britain, and we ignore the appallingly recruited and badly paid workers who produced the metals so that Britain could build aeroplanes, so that people here could eat. And that also is just wiped out of history in this country. So I thought, well, let me put it together, so we can recognize that, in my mind, Britain could not have won the war without America, of course, but also without the colonial contributions.
All right, Ms. Sherwood, I thank you very much, and we will talk to you a little bit later. And thank everyone for listening. I'd like to thank Lisa Watkins for her technical brilliance today, and we will see you in the whirlwind. Take care.
Thank you very much indeed, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye.